Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dobert. Today's guest, Garry Kasparov, the former chess grandmaster and now big critic of Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump, and pretty much everything about U.S.-Russia relations. And he's got a lot of criticism to go around. He says George W. Bush and Barack Obama both helped enable Putin's rise as a world player. He calls it action through inaction, getting played by Putin at pretty much every step of the way. Half Jewish, half Armenian, Kasparov, as a teenager, became an international celebrity while traveling the world and a symbol of Soviet pride back home. Chess got him involved in politics and both got him involved in pushing hard for open democracy. He tried to run against Putin's temporary presidential placeholder, Dmitry Medvedev, for the presidency in 2008, but was barred from the ballot by the kind of authoritarian regime technicality built to block opposition and had to do with not renting the right-sized space to gather supporters. And he ended up boycotting the election entirely. Now, he lives in New York, but I caught up with him at a conference recently in Lisbon called the Web Summit. Kasparov was there in his role with a group called Avast, trying to get more attention for how state-sponsored propaganda and fake news is working. That conversation is one that's paralyzed American politics, I told him. So he said to me, you can lose the war even if you have an overwhelming advantage militarily, economically, technologically, if you don't recognize you are at war. Back when I was playing a lot of chess as a kid, yeah, there are even a couple of weeks at chess camp in my childhood, Kasparov was the biggest thing around. We talked about what I learned as the basic lesson of the game, be able to think just one move ahead and you're going to be better than most of the players out there. Of course, he was the grandmaster, so he pointed out that it's even better if you can think two or three moves ahead. So I asked him what he makes of all the talk of Trump and Putin as playing chess or three-dimensional chess. He was not a fan. He told me that he feels like it's his duty to defend the game. Naturally, I asked him who would win a chess game between Trump and Putin in his mind. You'll hear what he had to say. Remember to subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. I'll just tease you with one of the episodes we've got coming up, David Petraeus. So you'll want to hear that one and the others that we're going to finish the year up with and get into with all the political insanity of 2018. Follow me on Twitter and on Facebook at Isaac Dobert and email me your thoughts and suggestions at isaac@politico.com. And now, my conversation with Garry Kasparov.
Sometimes in American politics, you hear people talking about President Trump and others playing three-dimensional chess and seeing things that other people aren't seeing.
When I hear phrases like Putin played chess, Obama played checkers, or moreover, Trump plays chess, I feel I have my duty to defend the game that I've been playing for decades. Game of chess is a game of strategy. Of course, you have many opportunities to show your tactical skills, but foremost, it's about strategy. And also, it's a transparent game. It's 100% transparency. So you know what I have, I know what you have. So we don't know the intentions of the opponent, but we know the resources our opponent can use to do us harm. Speaking about Putin, chess doesn't fit his image for two reasons. One is he's a KGB guy, he hates transparency, and he's a dictator. And dictators, apart of the fact that they hate transparency, and they operate in shadows or even in darkness, dictators, they're tacticians. They're more like poker players. They can gamble because it's all about short-term reaction. That's where dictator is strong, because he doesn't have to care about parliament approval, public reaction, free press criticism. So that's why within a short-term action, dictator will always have an upper hand over democratic elected leader who has to go through all these procedures looking for consensus and approvals. So that's why strategy is a main component of the success of the democracy, and it's a pity that we don't see strategy being applied on our side in the free world. We yet to see political leaders who can think beyond the term in the office. That's what strategy means, because in democracy you have continuity. Dictator doesn't care what happens when he's gone. So it's all about survival. Now, democratic leaders, they could install the program that will work way beyond their term in the office. And moreover, it could even benefit political opponents that will win later on. So to use words, strategy or chess, to characterize Trump's rule, for me, it's inconceivable. Trump is not even a rational person. So he operates in not even a short-term environment, but in an extremely short-term environment. So, the way he communicates with the world definitely shows lack of any strategical calculations.
You are a much better chess player than I ever was. but when I was learning how to play, a teacher told me, if you just start thinking one move ahead, it will change the game. And I have found that it's true that the difference between Grandmaster is a different thing, but between many amateur chess players it's a huge difference between the people who can see one move on the board ahead.
And those who can see two moves.
Well, then, and the more you can see, the better you can be, right? And so that's to your point here, is that you feel like there's nobody seeing a move ahead here.
I think some people probably can, but they don't want to, because it's the moment you start calculating just one, two, three moves ahead, so you will find out instantly that the right moves may not serve your immediate purpose. And if your priority to win, score some points while you're in the office, and maybe to win midterm elections or next elections, then strategy could be a liability, no longer an asset. And going back to Trump, the way he speaks to the rest of the world via his Twitter, and it shows that he finds himself most comfortable in the environment of a live TV show, and there is no room for strategy there. So, and he doesn't care about strategy, because strategy is something that goes way beyond his horizon. It's all about winning now, or moreover, it's not just winning now. It's about the image. So he wants to look like someone who is winning now. It doesn't matter whether he's winning and tomorrow it could be a big loss, but it's all about impression now. That's even probably shorter term calculation than Putin's side.
Many people, I think, know you from your chess days and maybe don't realize how that led into what you do with yourself now.
Chess in the Soviet Union was a highly politicized game. It was viewed for decades by the communist leadership as a very important tool to demonstrate an intellectual superiority of the communist regime over decadent West. So it's a demonstration of the intellectual power. And as the rising star, I was engaged in these fights, since I had to challenge for the world title Anatoly Karpov, who was a darling of the system, who was ethnic Russian. I was half Armenian, half Jewish, from the deep south of the USSR, a city of Baku, just as the Caspian Sea. I learned very quickly that's the way it worked in the Soviet Union. And also, my upbringing in Baku, mainly with the my late father's brother and other members of these Jewish intellectual circles there, taught me about the outside world. And also, I could travel as the chess prodigy. My first trip abroad was in 1976 at age 13.
Yeah. Which is, seeing things that people in the Soviet Union weren't seeing.
Not most. It's just, I think I was the only one, definitely in my school and probably my neighborhood who ever visited the capitalist country. So Soviet Union was a closed country, even in the 70s. And I could clearly see the differences. When I was about to challenge Karpov, so I already had my views about the world that were contradictory with the official ideology in the Soviet Union. When I became world champion in 1985, by the way, actually 32 years ago exactly on that day, November 9th. So that's a good day to remember that moment. So it was a time of change under Gorbachev, and I had strong feelings that as one of the most famous persons there, very young and just dynamic, and I had my duty to join this fight for change and to show other people that they don't have to stay away. So it's about demonstrating that your engagement can change something. So it's my view at that time was that if I stay away, that sends a wrong signal. If I get in, maybe it will motivate a lot of people to join the fight for the better future. I was pretty active in late 80s, early 90s, but after 1991, collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, so I thought maybe I have to just do other things in chess. But I was coming back and forth because I could see dangers of the potential communist return. And then, of course, in 2000, when Yeltsin picked up KGB Lieutenant Colonel as his successor, I was really worried because...
You worried from the beginning.
Look, it's on the record. So I just, I don't have to say, I thought about it. It's not about being money quarterback. So my first article about dangers of Vladimir Putin regime dated all the way back to January 2001.
It's an
editorial in the Wall Street Journal. Because I already could hear all these noises. That's for a trained ear of somebody who grew up in the Soviet Union and had some, acute political senses. That was clear. When you hear Vladimir Putin still as a prime minister and Yeltsin's successor, spoke to his former colleagues at KGB, at the KGB headquarters in Lubyanka, saying, once KGB, always KGB, that there are no former KGB guys. He spoke about the collapse of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, and as the president of Russia, one of his first acts was to restore Soviet anthem. You look at just at these three episodes, and for me it was clear that what he would do if given the chance. And I've been trying to raise this awareness. And of course, he immediately attacked the free press. And attacking free press just was a prelude for what to follow. And if some people who I worked with had still doubts that maybe it was just temporary setback, after what happened to Khodorkovsky, to Yukos, when Putin destroyed the most successful business empire in Russia and split it between his buddies. So we had no doubts. So unfortunately, we had no response from the free world. So the leaders of the free world pretended or believed that Putin could be a good partner. Yes, maybe he did something that they wouldn't approve. In Russia, who cares? Because he could be someone to work with on the international arena. And for many years, that was during Bush 43 administration, heard from top officials, Condoleezza Rice said many times, maybe it's not democratic, but it's much better than Soviet Union.
There's that famous line from George W. Bush.
Bush he looked into his eyes. 1991. He looked in his eyes and saw his soul.
No, well, that's George W. Bush.
I'm talking about Bush 43 administration. Yeah. Yes, that was actually in June before 9/11. Right. So, I have to say that it was just one of the first Putin's triumphs, psychological triumphs, because he could. I mean, it was a KGB guy. So, and he had his first experience with the leader of the free world, and he immediately saw an opportunity just to impress Bush 43 with his story. And what would be the best story for W than Putin's revelations about being baptized secretly and having the cross hidden. Give me a break. In KGB. But it worked. So that's, and that's, you know, that was the beginning of Putin's subtle way of grabbing attention and then sympathies from the Western leaders. If it didn't work, he always had money available. So as the, like with Schroeder or Berlusconi. But we have to give him credit for being very smart in building these relations. Very personal. Yes, maybe I did something that you wouldn't approve with Russia. But look, we have so much to accomplish together. Yeah, Afghanistan, for instance. He was always very good in making this bargain.
And you see now where he's positioned himself in North Korea with President Trump.
But that's the same as Syria. I mean, it's just his algorithm in dealing with the free world hasn't changed. But what has changed dramatically is that instead of looking for friends, now he needs enemies. That's typical for a dictator. He has been building his power in Russia. And at certain point, every dictator finds out that when all the political opponents in the country have been eliminated, suppressed, you need other enemies because dictators need enemies. And you go beyond your borders. And if you want to look strong, you need stronger enemies. You need to defy someone who looks so strong that it automatically gives you extra power in the eyes of your subjects.
Have you ever met Putin yourself?
No, but I've met enough KGB lieutenant colonels in my life. One more, one less.
It's the same.
Though
thing
I have to give them credits for being, you know, just a very savvy player and somebody who is staying in power for 18 years.
Of a big, complicated country, right?
And also terrorizing the rest of the world. So with fairly limited resources, it's because the Soviet Union was much more powerful economically and militarily than Putin's Russia.
Well, one of the things that Obama would say about Putin all the time is he would say, well, he doesn't have a great economy there. He doesn't, you know, would sort of minimize Putin.
The funny thing that Obama was right about economy, but he was absolutely wrong that economy either was any of Putin's concerns. Putin knows, I think instinctively, it's like a street fighter, these instincts that probably just innate instincts, that dictator is not challenged due to economic hardship. Dictator is in trouble when he looks weak. The moment he looks weak and vulnerable, something happens.
Well, I mean, there is this, and I'm sure you're aware of it, and among some American politicians within the Republican Party, there is this sensibility that, oh, Putin he's a real leader. We saw this after what happened in Ukraine. That was the first time that really flared up because it was opposed to Obama, right? It was, he's a real leader. He's strong. He gets things done. And it was a way, in part, of attacking Obama. But then we've seen that sense has stayed through, in some quarters, through what the end of Obama, the beginning of Trump. President Trump seems to be impressed with Putin. He said during the campaign last year, one of the things that struck a lot of people at the time was, people want me to attack him, but he says nice things about me. Why would I attack a guy who says nice things about me?
Trump has never attacked any autocrat in the world. So when you look at people Trump admires, it includes Putin, Xi Jinping, Erdogan, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Instinctively, Trump wants to be like them. So, and Trump talks like autocrat. He walks like autocrat. The good thing, he cannot act like autocrat. He's in the United States. But there are no doubts where Trump's sympathies lie. Now, going back to Obama years, but we also, you know, should not ignore the fact that Obama's administration, I think it's out of this ideological naivety. They tried to build good relations with Putin, desperately looking for
reset,
but then also looking for common ground. There was no common ground because even if Putin pretended that he wanted to help in Syria, it was all about just using an opportunity. And he was very good in grabbing every opportunity. The moment Obama created a vacuum, Putin grabbed it. And Syria was not only propping up Assad, though it was very important, because Obama said Assad must go, and Putin said, uh-uh. And it's for Putin, it's a demonstration that if you stick to me, stick with me, I will protect you, even if the United States, the most powerful nation on earth, wants you out. And also he used Syrian crisis to push millions of refugees to Europe, which helped, as he correctly calculated, alt-right in Europe, and all of them were his natural allies, wanted to lift sanctions on Russia and also to destabilize the European political landscape.
So does Obama help create the conditions that turn Putin into what he is now,
of course,
in the world?
Inaction. So this is, and by the way, Obama had, I think it's not later than July 2016, all information about Putin's hybrid war against the United States. And again, he tried to keep his hands clean. He didn't want to intervene. He thought Hillary would win anyway. And now we saw the outcome. But Trump is a different story because we have so many inconsistencies in the testimonies of Trump's people that, and if you start adding what you could read from Russian media, Kremlin-controlled media, and if I combine it with my own experience of KGB run operations, clearly there's more than just mutual admiration between Trump and Putin.
What the Russian media part of it, outside of your own experience, what are you seeing there that's pointing you that way?
Oh, it was just, it's from the very beginning, they were supporting Trump. Actually, the support for Trump was it was changing, at the different stages of presidential campaign, because originally it was more about. It's the Trump demonstrates how corrupt is the system. It's a circus. So, because this is classic of Putin's propaganda shtick now. We're bad, everybody's bad. We're corrupt, everybody's corrupt.
Which,
we
by the way, right, Trump says something. He said in one of the interviews at one point, he said, "Well,
O'Reilly,
we're
yes.
not that innocent
yes,
ourselves."
Yes, we also
right?
kill our people.
Yeah,
but
right?
this is a classical propaganda shtick of not only Putin. Probably, it's truth is relative. So this everybody's bad. Everybody does bad things. So it's moral relativism. It's whataboutism. So and Putin was very good in just in selling this narrative. Because unlike the Soviet propaganda machine, he doesn't have to sell you ideology. It's not about, communism is good. No, he doesn't care. So he can support far left. He can support alt-right. Everything that disturbs the status quo, everything that spreads chaos, good for him. And they could see Trump as a potential chaos maker in America. Then they shifted to another narrative when they saw Trump was doing well and he was about to become a nominee. So it was about, great guy. He would never win because system was corrupt. So, and Trump kept repeating it. Election would be rigged. Election would be rigged. I could hear because I could read both news pegs on Russian and English, how the Russian bots have been spreading this Kremlin narrative. Elections would be rigged. I think they might even surprised a year ago when Trump won. But then it was massive celebration. And you could read sometimes between the lines, sometimes almost openly preaching Trump as someone who would change everything in Russian-American relations. And I have no doubt that Putin's dream was another big Crimea meeting, big Yalta to divide the world. And we heard from many people on the Trump side, from Michael Flynn, Newt Gingrich once called Tallinn, a suburb of St. Petersburg. I mean, it's when you recognize that he called a capital of a NATO country a suburb of St. Petersburg. So I think it's psychologically they were preparing American public for a big deal. And it was easy to sell to Trump. Look, who cares about the small countries? It's about big guys getting together and deciding everything for the rest.
That's different from they bought the election. They hacked the election.
But it's, but it's what bought. You know, it's I'm not in the position to tell you that what Kremlin did was a decisive factor. Though I think if you look at the big numbers, it was. The difference between winning and losing for Trump was less than 100,000 votes in three states. Now, Facebook just confirmed that 126 million Americans watched Russian bot ads. Now, if we believe that negative advertising has any value, it probably was enough to actually shift these votes, because it was not just all over America. It's very clear that they actually got some advice in America. That's why I suspect they were in collision with Trump's campaign to attack special states and even districts. They knew where to put these ads. So even with Facebook, and we're not talking about other botnets, so because they have been spreading wide, and they did a pretty good job, because this is not new for us who are familiar with this technique in Russia, because Putin started this operation in Russia more than 10 years ago, trying to undermine the presence of Russian opposition in the internet. They developed this technique of creating these fake websites. I call them fake because it's not just fake news. They were splitting the message. It's not like one channel tells you everything that Putin wants to communicate. It's about one channel saying a little piece of the story, but also packaging it in Putin's criticism. They knew how to create something that people can trust. It's about building credibility. Somebody who's saying Putin is corrupt and these guys just are stealing from Russian treasury, but you cannot think about KGB being behind the apartment bombing in Moscow. So, and then they move this technique of truth is relative, fake news, using troll factories to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, neighboring countries, then to Europe, and eventually to the United States. So when Americans actually were targeted, they had more than 10 years of experience with a very refined strategy how to do that.
But now you bring up fake news. That's your big project now, is trying to talk about what state-sponsored fake news propaganda is doing all around. Why is that where you land in this?
Yeah, but it brings together technology. That's AI and other things that I'm familiar with, but also with a political message. And I think it's very important that we realize that it's a different kind of war. It's a conflict. You may call it hybrid war, but it's a post-industrial war. But this is something that Putin has invented, and it's not just Putin. It's we could see how all these new technological devices being used by dictators and thugs and terrorists quite effectively to rally support and to undermine the very foundation of the democracy in the free world. I'm just trying to explain so that it's, while we cannot stop it because it's a globalized world, but we have to be aware that we are at war. So you can lose the war even if you have overwhelming advantage, militarily, economically, technologically, if you don't recognize you are at war. And this war will not stop. And that's one of the very important messages that, because for Putin, for Kim Chen In, for ISIS, you name, for Iranian mullahs, confrontation with the free world is the only way to justify their rule. It's very much the core of their message to the public, because what else they can sell? They cannot compete in innovations, in technology, in productivity, but they don't care about human lives. For us, each loss of human life is tragic. For them, killing 100,000 people, it's just a demonstration of their strengths.
But it seems like in the U.S., there's a paralysis around this issue. Even as we get the Facebook testimony and see information come out, what happened with Twitter, what happened with the bots, there's not a sense of urgency to things. And I wonder if you think that this is
if you think
done.
That if you think that just your elections being influenced by a foreign adversary is not enough to act, so I cannot help. But it's
no. I mean, it's. Yeah. I think there are a lot of people who are very concerned about it, but overall, there does seem to be this shrug that people have.
And I think it's countries waking up slowly. So again, I wish it could have happened earlier. But the problem, I think, is it's not just a shrug. I think it's some sort of intellectual self-deception, because people recognize that if they accept these facts and if they recognize that the threat is real, they have to act. And acting means they have to start confrontation. It's a policy of deterrence. And in the modern political climate, inaction cannot be criticized for inactions. Maybe after you left the office like Obama. But while you're there, if you try to protract the agony, if you drag your feet, nah, it's not a big deal. If you do something and you're wrong, which can happen, then you could be ostracized. So that's why I think instinctively there is just, there's always politicians are tempted to find this, what I call middle ground, but basically to do nothing. So not to cross the red line. So, I think it's, unless the concept of deterrence in the cyber war is being declared, as in the 40s, the Truman administration built institutions to fight communism in the Cold War, by the way, building from the scratch. So these institutions like National Security Council, CIA, NATO. Unless we do something that is adequate to respond to these threats, we will be bumping at the same wall, because Putin is not going to stop. I've been saying all the time that with Putin is not if he would strike. It's only when and where.
It's about 20 years since your match with Deep Blue, which you said changed your whole sense of artificial intelligence, which seems like it and computers and everything and how. So I wonder if you could just talk about what you think that does to now in 2017, where we are in this question and what. You have this new book where you say that it actually, it's not a threat to mankind. It allows mankind to do more, right? And to be more human.
Look, my attitude after that match was you cannot beat them, join them. So I still played a few more matches after 1997 with other computers. And I think we were still, within the range of our ability to compete. So it was just 2005, 2006, where machines, other computers, chess engines, became unbeatable. And few people realized that today, the free chess app on your mobile device is stronger than Deep Blue. But there was... No, I just it's, I probably can play, but it's just, no, it's... the reason is they have steady hand. Machines just, they... It's not very impressive game, but they just don't make the same mistakes human do, and we lose our vigilance. So even the best of us, at much younger age, I was vulnerable to the moments of weakness. But I think it's not about competing with machines; it's about collaborating with machines. Because what we know today, talking about. The real AI, though I'm still, I'm not comfortable with artificial intelligence concept. I always call it augmented intelligence. I think it's more precise. Deep Blue was not intelligent. It was brute force. 200 million positions per second, but it's brute force with good algorithms and some training.
All right, last question here. I know you said that neither Trump or Putin are chess players in your mind, but imagine that they're sitting down playing each other. What does that game look like?
Oh, look, it is this. Both of them despise playing by the rules. So that's it's who will cheat first, yes. But I would in any game of wits, I would bet on Putin, unfortunately.
All right, Garry Kasparov, thanks for taking the time.
That was Garry Kasparov, thanks to Bridget Mulcahy for coming back to help with producing this episode, and Zach Stanton as always. Remember to subscribe and rate us and spread the word. And follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Isaac Dover. Catch you next time on Off Message.